Accession number 17181, Reel 5.
Mr. Unwin, Reel 5.
At the drinking point, Lenny Banks was inviting me down, encouraging me to join him and go down in the stoker's mess. And I was weighing up in my mind, whether I should or whether I should go back to the cabin. And just at that very moment, an enormous man, a naval officer, an enormous fellow, towered above me, and he tapped me on the head and he said, "Now come along, sonny, where have you come from?" And I can hear his voice now. And I said, down the corridor. He said, "Well, off you go back there, there's a lot of people coming." And Lenny Banks went down into the stoker's mess and I went back to the cabin. And when I got back, I couldn't in fact get a seat again in the cabin. So I sat down in the corridor. The corridors along the ship were divided into sections with steel doors separating sections. So when you went along a corridor, you went through two or three doors, which were, it was metal from floor to ceiling, but the door didn't start until about 15 or 18 inches up the wall, above the floor level. You stepped over that to go through. And I sat down in the corridor. And we were fairly near the front of the ship. I didn't know quite how far it was, but I was fairly sure I was somewhere near the front of the ship. And at this time, I think even before I'd gone for a drink of water, over the tannoys had come the first announcement, enemy aircraft approaching. And you were just sort of wondering what was going to happen now. So we were sitting down and chatting in this corridor, and suddenly the ship was hit for the first time, and the bomb it was from a Stuka, and it had the Orion, incidentally, was not an anti-aircraft cruiser, so it didn't offer the protection that the Carlisle had. We were to learn this very much to our cost. And the bomb had gone down through the forward gun turrets, right through a number of messes, and burst in the very lower part of the ship. And it caused an enormous... It caused chaos. The ship, the front of the ship, the prow of the ship, started going up in the air. And then it started going down. When it was going up, it seemed as though it was never going to stop. And then when it was going down, it seemed as though it was never going to stop. Eventually, it righted itself. But the door on our right, at the right end of the corridor, led to the main part of the ship. The door at the left led forward. And on the inside of the corridor, at the left-hand end of it, was a door from down below, a companionway, sort of a ladder thing, I think, going down to a floor below. And that had been open, and terrible, terrible fumes started coming. Oh, and when it went off, we were all hurled along. Everybody was just heaped along, bodily moved along into an enormous mass of arms and legs and bodies at the left-hand end. With the force of the explosion. So we sorted ourselves out, but dense fumes started coming up this companionway and filling our corridor. So there was no alternative, but we tried that way and couldn't get through to get back to the main part of the ship. We couldn't open the door at that time. So we opened the door on the left, and this was the very forward part of the ship, and it housed the anchor chain, an enormous horizontal wheel around which the anchor chain was... The anchor chain was wound around the wheel, and this took up a very large part of the area available to us. And being the being the very prow of the ship, it actually closed in to nothing. The port side met the starboard side, that was the front. And there were two portholes on the left and port, and presumably two on starboard. But the two on starboard had, the ship had had a near miss in the approach to Crete, and it had been sandbagged up inside the ship against a bulwark, I think it's called the bulwark. That had been sandbagged up, so that those portholes were obliterated. We only had two portholes, and one of those we couldn't open. And it was pretty awful in this room. There were a lot of sailors' lockers, personal lockers, and rather like filing cabinets, and the room was filled with those, and we just sat on the floor in between them all. But everybody wanted to get by this open porthole and get a breath of fresh air. So there was a general milling around. And time passed. We didn't know what had happened about the bomb. But we knew that we couldn't go back through this gas-filled place. And we stayed there. And through all this time, the floor of this room wasn't sealed because of the wheel for the anchor chain. There was sound access from somewhere down below. And we heard the terrible moanings. It was an Australian voice. Terrible moanings all day of somebody who'd been injured. We didn't know where he was or what had happened to him. And it was mostly moaning, not speaking. But that went on through the day. And we were under constant attack. The Stukas kept coming over in waves. What had happened, what led to this, was that the ship should have sailed to get past Rhodes. It had to go through a strait between Rhodes and Crete, and the Stukas were based on Rhodes, and we should have been away and clear before daylight. But something had happened to a destroyer, and we were held up because of the whatever happened to the destroyer. I think that was called the Hereward. And we hadn't got clear of Rhodes before daylight, so we were spotted, and the Stukas were with us from daylight on. And as they dropped their bombs, so they came down and strafed the ship, and we were underneath the open deck so that you could hear this rattle of their bullets hitting the deck, brrr, as they zoomed across the deck all the time. This was going on all the time, and people who were up on deck were firing back with all, whatever they had. And a message was passed down to this porthole, and is on a rope, and it read, "Pass any arms up." And people had bits of ammunition about them, and one or two rifles. We tied these onto the rope, and they went up to the deck above, and then the second bomb hit, and this was dreadful. Again, it really seemed as though the ship was going to turn right over, prow end first, and then it really seemed as though it was going to plunge to the bottom of the sea. And we'd been hit again in the controls, in on the bridge. The bridge had suffered this time, and we were just hapless in this room. But it was so awful. There was a Scotsman, a Scots soldier, and we were all crouching on the floor. These filing cabinets, the sailors' lockers, they were all metal things and quite flush with the floor, but you were desperate enough to wonder how you could crawl under them for shelter. And the Scots fellow, throughout the day, was saying, "May the Lord have mercy on our souls," and nobody had the heart to tell him to stop. So we had the Australian somewhere down below us moaning with injuries, and this Scotsman beseeching help from the Lord, and the day passed like that. And orders were given to abandon ship, we learned afterwards. And another attack came over, and this had to be put off. The ship had to be abandoned, or was going to be abandoned, because the steering gear, the steering controls, had been wrecked in the set by the second bomb, and the captain had been killed by the second bomb. And having gone through the bridge, the bomb had then exploded in the medical bay below, where all the casualties from the first bomb were being taken. So it was a terrible, terrible state. And we knew nothing of the order to abandon ship, but we were just simply locked in this place. And eventually we tried to get out, but we went into our own corridor, and by this time the fumes had disappeared. And we opened the door to the next corridor, and it was full of water up to the level of the base of the door. Water had filled the corridor, and all the people who'd been sitting there hadn't been bundled along to the end of the corridor the way we had. They'd just been killed by blast, just as they sat there. So there were two rows of fellows, all dead, along this, for the full length of this corridor. And the people went through that corridor and opened the next door, and there was firefighting going on. People in asbestos suits were still fighting a fire, and they were on the far side of the fire. So there was no... We just had to stay where we were. We went back to the prow. And the ship was guided to Alexandria by a destroyer in front of it. And the ship just simply followed the destroyer. When we got to Alexandria, this couldn't happen because there was a zigzag through a minefield. And we had to be towed through that. So it was a very, very, very slow approach into Alexandria. And we were eventually able to go on deck. And when we got on deck, the sight was absolutely dreadful. The front gun turret, the sides of it were lying flat on the deck. The front of it was still in position. But the two guns, these six-inch guns, I think, six-inch or four-fives, very, very heavy pieces of metal. One of them was bent. It was bent in a great arc of a circle, the steel barrel of the gun. The other one was not bent, and a gunner was still sitting on the seat alongside the gun. But he'd suffered terribly. His head had gone. And on the forward mast up above, the yardarm, I think it's the yardarm, the piece that goes across the top, there was a bib and brace overall of one of the crew fluttering on that. It had just been blown off him and landed right at the top of the mast and stuck on the yardarm. And the rail all round the ship had been blown off. There was hardly any rail around the ship. It was just total destruction and chaos, the deck of the ship. And the people that had been on deck had suffered terribly. A lot of them had been machine gunned. Quite a lot of people had simply lost their grip, lost their reason, and just jumped into the sea. And there was no way anybody could stop and pick them up. People were lost like that. People down in the lower decks, where the fumes, most of the people inside the ship were killed by fumes from these bombs. And in desperation, people had been just piling out portholes from the decks, mess decks or whatever rooms they were in, where the portholes were, and just simply gone into the sea. And eventually we got into Alexandria. And my unit lost almost all the NCOs. It was remarkable how the NCOs were wiped out almost to a man on that ship. There were many hundreds of casualties. I belong to the Orion Society, and they issue documents, and it talks about, I think, maybe 279 casualties. But we always understood it was more than up around the 500 mark. And I don't think the 279 casualties is the people they took off at Alexandria, not the people who landed up in the sea. It was a pretty awful experience. I think that's the Orion.
Were you then remustered into a new unit?
No, we reformed because half the unit had got back to Alexandria anyway, in the evacuation of Greece. And we were not entirely wiped out, so we must have been about three-quarters of the battery. And about this time, the troops from Abyssinia came back from Abyssinia, and then we rejoined our own regimental, we became our own complete unit again. And we were given fairly easy tasks for some time, some months. This happened in May, the end of May, and we spent some time in different places around Alexandria and down at Cairo. And then we were equipped with new guns. They were 4.5s, a more modern gun this time. They fired 100-pounder shells. And in November of 41, we went back into the desert.
And into the front line?
Into the front line, yes. Yes. There was a funny thing about this thing, this medium regiment business. There was a sense of hopelessness, almost of despair. You were never out of action. Each division that went in had its own field artillery, 25-pounders and anti-tank guns and that sort of thing. But no divisions had medium artillery. Medium artillery were support troops. So you were just attached to whichever division was in action, and we were with the 6th Australian Division. We supported New Zealanders. We did exercises with the French Foreign Legion at Bir Tamarad, and eventually the South Africans came. We were with the 1st South African Division, the 2nd South African Division, and it really seemed as though there was never going to be any end to it. As long as the war went on, the medium regiments available would be in action. At the time a slogan developed in the unit: roll on Stalag, roll on Stalag. And yet the one thing you didn't think about was that you'd become prisoner. This was a remarkable thing. It was a great shock to be taken prisoner. But what happened from November 41, we went back into the desert. And we spent Christmas 41 at a place called Sidi Aziz, which is the spot at which we spent Christmas 1940. It was a remarkable thing. And we went through again, but we were stopped at Tobruk. We relieved the Australians at Tobruk. Tobruk had been a bridgehead held by the Australian troops. And in about December or so of 1941, we relieved the garrison there, broke through, and Tobruk was then liberated. Oh, it never had been, it had just been made a bridgehead. It hadn't, liberated is the wrong word. It was open again. And after that, the Germans seemed to take control after that. We never went further forward than that. And a line you probably know of, the Gazala line, was formed. This was about 40 miles to the west of Tobruk. And we were in a gun position there for many months. It seemed many months. I think it was many months. We were there, and guns would be taken out. We'd go down to the south of the line and support the Free French I mentioned at Bir Tamarad. No, not Bir Tamarad, Bir Hakim. And then come back to our own position. And on occasions, guns would be taken, individual one or two guns would be taken forward on an exercise. We'd move forward towards the Germans and do harassing fire at night and then clear out and get back to our own lines, our own gun position. And I mentioned Bir Tamarad. Bir Tamarad is an odd thing. It was a well in the middle of the desert. And there was access, a hole in the rock, big hole in the rock. And down below there was a pool, permanent pool of water, drinking water. And it was in no man's land. So we used to use it, but so did the Germans. And there was an accepted drill for this, that when you got to the crest to which you could see the well, if German trucks were there, you didn't go. And they never came while we were there. So it was a sort of gentleman's agreement that this water was for both sides. That would be a tamrad. And then there was the attack on the Ghazala line, and they more or less routed us on this, and we fell back into Tobruk. And
any details you can give of that German attack, as far as you remember it?
No, I don't. We got orders to move. We didn't fire from there. The line was a number of boxes, and it was the southernmost boxes, I think, which were breached. It was thought that the gaps between the boxes were sufficiently well mined to stop any force getting through, but they did get through. They routed those two boxes, and we were exposed on the northern flank, and we just simply got ordered to get out, fall back into Tobruk. So we didn't take part in the action defending the Ghazala line. I'm sure we didn't fire then. And when we got into the Tobruk garrison, we had a position on the southern sector. And we were only five guns. Only our Charlie troop got back into Tobruk, but Don troop, which is a four-gun troop, they got the chance to make a break for it, and they got away from Tobruk and headed down the desert towards Cairo. But they only had three guns. The fourth gun, had a breach, and what do you call it when? It had a premature. It had blown up. The battle had blown up. And this killed a few fellows. But it had come back into Tobruk to be fitted with a new battle. So that was lying in Tobruk when we got there, our four guns, and we became a five-gun troop then. It was ready for action again. And we became a five-gun troop. And we were at El Adam Airport was on the south side of Tobruk, and we were on that sector. And the 7th Medium were also, they'd also come into Tobruk, and they had their eight guns, and it was thought that the attack would come through El Adam, and the eight-gun battery would be much better deployed in a position in which we were. So the 7th Medium moved into the area we were occupying, and we moved to the western edge of the sector. And of course, the attack did come through the El Adam place. We felt very aggrieved about this, because the tank force that came through was about 40 tanks strong, I think. I'm quoting from memory now, and I'm speaking against history books and whatnot, but this is my memory. About 40 tanks took part in the attack, and they broke through, and the following morning they'd come right across the sector and were approaching us, but they were approaching us from behind, and we had our guns in gun pits. We dug them in fairly well, and you can't turn a 4.5 gun round in its pit, so we weren't able to fire on them. And as it started soon after daylight that they were moving up to us, and they had tanks approaching, and behind the tanks were mobile guns. This is a thing we hadn't seen in our army at that time, but it's like a big open top tank which has a big piece of artillery on it. And they were firing airburst just hundreds of yards in front of the tanks and bursting over us. It was pretty awful. And the order came through from the command post. Well, as a command post, we had a marvellous command post. It was an Australian post from the siege. So it was beautifully constructed, a timber-constructed thing with a shaft to go down, and had a lovely equipped command post down below. But we simply couldn't operate at all. And some South African 25-pounders had moved in the night before and taken up a position just a couple of hundred yards behind us. And they weren't firing. They weren't doing anything. And slowly the tanks, they could have turned their guns. This is no problem at all. But they didn't take the tanks on. The tanks just rolled across. And we saw German troops jumping out of their vehicles and hitching the 25-pounders onto the gun towers which were there and driving them away. No effort had been made to destroy them at all. And then eventually the order came from the command post, prepare to destroy your guns. So the system I'd mentioned, speaking about Lamia in Greece, that went into that, shells were rammed down the front of the gun, put into the breech and all ready to fire. And the four sergeants, the four gun sergeants, the ground was covered with telephone cables from the siege. There were miles and miles of telephone cable all over the place. And telephone cable had been tied onto the lanyard. The lanyard is a yard-long piece of steel wire which has a mechanism that fires the gun, causes the gun to fire, and it has a handle at the end. You just simply pull it like that and the gun alongside you fires, no problem. But when you're trying to blow the thing up, you can't stand a yard from it. So they had long lengths of telephone wire, and from slit trenches 20 or 30 yards away they were doing it. Three of the guns blew up, exploded, terrible bangs, and pieces of steel were all over the place. The other one didn't. And this for Franklin Briggs again, funny how his name keeps cropping up. He stuck his head out of the command post, said, "Sergeant Forshaw, have you destroyed your gun?" Said, "No." "Then destroy it." And the language then can't be repeated. But it boiled down to, if you want to destroy the thing, come and destroy it yourself. For these airburst shells were all over the place. And eventually, another sergeant, a fellow called Holland, a young fellow, he dashed over to the gun and picked up the wire at some point and pulled it after the break. And the gun exploded. So they were all safely exploded. And he suffered a broken wrist or sprained wrist or something. And then the tanks arrived. The tanks were only very, very short distance away then, just coming over a crest and hitching up all these South African guns. And the leading tank came up, and the tank commander was out of the turret. You could see his top half out of the turret. And he had a desert hat on, pulled round the sides of his face. But his face was ginger as could be with sand. It was just powdered with sand.